Well, croeso, and welcome to the very first Planet Art podcast. We've got Peter Lord here with us today. I'm very much looking forward to seeing what he's got to say. He'll be helped by picking in to his latest book, Relationships with Pictures, which is essentially about Peter and about his relationships with pictures. Helping me will be Lloyd Roderick. He's struggling through his PhD at the moment, so hopefully this interview will provide him with a little bit of light relief. And further to that, Alice Briggs will be joining us in the next podcast. She's currently in Venice at the Venice Biennale, in case you couldn't guess. She's looking at Bedwyr Williams's work and others, of course, and she'll be returning with thoughts and ideas about how that's turned out. Anyhow, join us after this little ditty, and I'll see you the other side. Well, Peter, thanks a lot for coming in. You've brought Relationships with Pictures with you, which is what we're going to hang this little talk on, but hopefully we'll be expanding it out. Well, let's talk about the book. Firstly, when did it start sort of ruminating with you? When did it start getting shape? And when did you first put pen to paper?
Well, it took quite a long time, in fact. And I wrote, well, I more or less finished writing the book a year before it was published. So it's a bit strange. It seemed like I felt a bit disconnected from it when I actually got the book in my hands, the physical book. So I suppose I'd been working on it for about 2 years before that. So the whole process from starting thinking about the book seriously and writing things down to publication was about 3 years, which is quite a long time, really.
Yeah.
For a not particularly big book.
And it's Parthian, which to me kind of signifies they don't have a huge art output. They do have some.
They do have some.
But
yeah.
Is this a distinct biography then, or is it more to do with literally your relationships with pictures?
Well, one of the things I liked about the experience of writing this book and the reception that it's had so far as well, although there haven't been any print reviews yet, but just anecdotally, privately, is that I'm able to present myself as a writer rather than as an academic, which I never was. You know, I didn't have any academic training as an art historian. A little at university, but and I'm really see myself. I think writing history is actually a very creative thing. It's to me not an academic exercise. Mm-hmm. And history is stories. Mm-hmm. I was thinking the other day actually about attitudes to history, and it struck me that, you know, history is one of the most difficult things in the world to predict. Which sounds bizarre, but it's because it's constantly changing. We write history for now. We don't really write it about the past. We're writing history for now, and so it is a creative thing. We reinvent it and in our own time. And what I wanted to do here was to, I suppose, be a little bit more upfront about how history is a very, very personal thing. Always has been for me. Parthian, being primarily a literary publisher rather than an academic publisher, like University of Wales Press, who I've worked with before. It was great that they were keen to do the book, that Richard Davis wanted to do the book. And I have to say, it's been a very pleasant relationship. I've really liked it. I've liked Parthian's attitude. I felt that I've been treated with respect, and that the publisher really, generally now, not just in my case, but the publisher really cares about writers and about writing. And that's not always the case with publishers in Wales.
Well, if we leave that point for 1 second, we'll come back to it, because yeah, it sounds quite interesting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the span of the chronology of it?
Well, the chronology of it is conventional. It starts with my childhood and it comes up to the latest things that I've been doing, I've been thinking about. But in a way, it evolves, perhaps in a slightly unexpected way. It is called an oblique autobiography. The first few chapters are very personal, as you'd expect, about childhood, about my father and so on. But as visual culture becomes more important to me through my life, the focus on particular pieces of work that I've done in visual culture becomes stronger. Some people have said to me that they feel the book changes in a way, and they've said that in a slightly negative sense. But as it goes through, because of this tighter focus on what you might call art history as it goes through. But that's not the case. It's all very much about me. It's just that art history's kind of taken over my life, hasn't it? And what I tried to do at the end, I had a long think about this, and I talked to John Barney in particular about this, whether or not to add a last chapter, and decided in the end to add a final chapter, which tried to set the whole thing in context of my broader thinking about my life and about everybody's life. It's an attempt to place this in a wider context. So the structure of the thing is unusual, because it's each chapter is linked to a particular image, visual image, and it is oblique in one sense, but it is very much an autobiography.
I think that's something that I quite enjoyed about it, really, was that combination of your professional work and the personal as well, and the background to that, because when you look at the more art historical writing or a traditional research in that sense, you get a text which is the culmination of research. But what I found this did, which I particularly enjoyed, was adding the background story and the insight of how that research came about. And that could have been through the breadcrumb trail of through document to document, or sometimes in just quite serendipitous or just by chance findings.
Yeah.
I think in particular as well, just towards the end of the book, you talk about John Carolus Williams and that's I think you call it a cache of pictures that came up through one of your friends finding that. So could you tell us a little bit more about that particular?
Yeah, that was an extraordinary story. I mean, I think that pictures have stories at various levels. They have the story of how the picture was created in the first place. It might be in the 15th century, 16th century, whenever. But then, so there's a set of relationships around that. The artist's relationship with the painting, if it's a painting, the patron, if it's a portrait, so on and so forth. But then, of course, the picture outlives the original context, and it goes through a whole series of different contexts. And ultimately, in the case of the pictures I talk about here, it comes into my sphere, and it's about how I've come into contact with these pictures and why they matter to me. In the case of John Carolus Williams, it's a particularly, we use the word serendipitous, I mean, it's an extraordinary story, really. Because a few years ago, I did a lot of work on Winifred Coombe Tennant, who was an important art patron of young Welsh painters in the 1920s. And one of the people that she promoted was this chap called John Carolus Williams. And I found half a dozen paintings of his paintings in her collection. Never heard of the man before, nobody else had heard of him, there was nothing published, didn't know anything about it. But they had that thing. They were good. You know, you can tell when somebody can paint, this guy could paint, you know. And so I showed them in an exhibition of her collection, and then didn't really make any progress with him at all. Lots of people said, oh, you know, very nice pictures. Who is he? Answer, don't know. Anyway, several years after that, two or three years after the exhibition, Mike Jones, painter, of course, well-known painter, friend of mine, was down at his local sale room. It's just a sort of an ordinary, not an art sale room, just an ordinary house clearance sale room down in Clydach. And he went in there one day poking about, and there were all these boxes full of pictures, just cardboard boxes, about four or five in each, sort of. And they were coming up in the next auction, and the idea was they were, you know, £5 a box sort of thing. And Mike looked at these pictures, pulled a couple out, and he thought, yeah, that's odd, you know, looked familiar to him in some way. But he couldn't place them, and then eventually pulled one out and had a signature on it. It was John Carolus Williams. Now, he'd seen the exhibition, and he'd noted John Carolus Williams then. And all of a sudden, there he is in this sale room, and there's 100 pictures by John Carolus Williams sitting there, you know. And unfortunately, Mike got in a bit of a paddy about this, and he said, oh, blimey, oh, terribly important. Went straight to the auctioneer and said, oh, you know, mustn't sell these, really important. Oh. You know, instead of keeping a cool head and saying, right, I'll just go along to the auction and get them for 25 quid the lot, you know. Anyway, the result was he phoned me up. We went down, catalogued the pictures, you know, great. But of course, the owner of the pictures, who'd just been clearing the house, he'd bought the house and was clearing it, found them in the attic. They were going to go on the on a bonfire. Literally, you know, it is actually a case. They were about to go on the bonfire. The only reason they didn't was because the auctioneer happened to be there and said, oh, you'll get a fiver for them or whatever, you know. But then we have this thing called the Antiques Roadshow effect, where when an owner suddenly discovers that somebody's interested in their pictures, they think they've got a house full of Rembrandts or something, which wasn't the case because, you know, there was no market value to the pictures, really, because there was nothing done. But anyway, that was the key moment. And because this collection survived, I was able to pursue the research and eventually find John Carolus Williams' niece, and so on and so forth, and the story emerged, and it was quite an extraordinary story, really, and a very sad story.
A lot of people will be aware of your work with Curtis Williams, for me, it strikes to me as if, you know, there's not many people that work the way you do Wales. You do often get your, you know, your hands dirty, and you make these trips to these attics and these sheds.
Oh, yeah.
How do you find your way to these places?
It's an instinct. It's just an instinct. It just happens. I don't know. I don't think there's any explanation for that. I mean, the other example is Archie Rhys Griffiths. Yeah. Another extraordinary story. And again, actually, curiously, quite close parallels there. And of course, they both were patronised by Winifred Coombe Tennant. It's just sort of, I don't know, it's a kind of sixth sense. I don't get mystical about it or anything, but I don't know. Somebody said to me the other day, because I made some comment about how when I first started researching Welsh visual culture, you know, back in the days when we were supposed to be an unvisual nation and we didn't have any paintings and all that nonsense. And I'd said to this guy, look, it was easy. They were everywhere. You know, it was just easy to do. I couldn't believe how easy it was to construct this, you know, idea of Welsh visual culture, as a construct a tradition. And he said, well, yeah, it was easy because your mind was prepared. And he said, all the big discoveries are made by well-prepared minds. I don't know who said that originally. It's apparently quite a famous quote to do with science. But I think that's the thing. I think because I came from outside and didn't have these preconceptions that my generation and older generations of people who've grown up in Wales had, I looked at it with a very different kind of attitude, both as an outsider and as somebody who belonged to a generation which was reconsidering what art history was anyway. It's now grandiosely called the new art history, you know, in the 70s and 80s, comes out of John Berger and people like that. And feminist art history, of course, important influence on me. So it's just, you know, it's a funny thing. If you imagine a table full of objects, you know, there's cups and saucers and goodness knows what on the table. And if you constantly look at it from one direction, when you're sitting at the table, just look at it from one direction, you've got half a dozen things across the front. Okay, so there your Augustus Johns and your Gwen Johns and you know, there's half a dozen famous people, Thomas Jones and all those. But nobody ever bothered to get up and walk around the side of the table, you see. But of course, if you walk around the side of the table or the back of the table and look at it, you get a completely different picture, and there's all this stuff hidden there. And that's all it was, really. It was just the ability to get up, walk around the side of the table and say, oh, hello, you know, there's another way of looking at this.
So what's your take on that then? Why wasn't anybody willing to just shift?
Oh, well, that's a very interesting question.
Shift along.
That's a very interesting question, which I've written about that to an extent. I mean, I think that there are a number of reasons for that. One was laziness, nothing more than that. Another was vested interest, because the main player in the field was the National Museum of Wales. And they had a vested interest at that time in presenting themselves as a high art museum, you know, on a parallel with high art museums everywhere else in the world. And of course, they were aided and abetted in that by the Davis sisters collection of Impressionist painting. They were able to do that. So they had no interest. In fact, it would have been, from their point of view, a negative thing to do, to start looking at, should we call it indigenous Welsh painting, whatever's the word, because it isn't that kind of high art, and it doesn't have that level of prestige internationally, which a big institution like that wants to maintain. And they were the sort of the main fly in the ointment, really. And it was also another curious thing, actually, which is among the, and I just caught the end of this, really. I remember Ross Bowen saying something about this once in a meeting I had with him to do with Stethford years ago, being very, very snooty about, I remember saying, well, who are these Welsh artists? Pwy o'r celfyddydwyr hyn, in his posh voice, that I was starting to talk about. Because coming out of a non-conformist Welsh tradition, it was almost a badge of pride with some people that we didn't have a visual tradition. Because in some way, people seemed to feel that elevated our literature and our music and made us special. It was the most bizarre kind of attitude. But it was there. Curious thing was, Eros Bowen, it turns out, had gone to art college. I didn't know that at the time. But anyway, no, there was a complex set of very interesting sociological things going on. And that's, of course, why I wrote The Aesthetics of Relevance, to draw attention to some of those, to look at the history of this.
That was a very important book, I think. It's a real backbreaker.
It was. It was, if I do say so myself, it did change things.
This might be the wrong company to be saying this, but it's a really important point, though. I mean, Lloyd, you and I have been discussing this idea of visuality. Why it's sort of kept, I wouldn't say under wraps, but certainly, you know, the word seems to be a little bit more precious. I was also in a podcast with Keith Morris recently.
Right.
And he was discussing along the same lines exactly what you were saying. And if anybody's interested, click along, leafing through. You'll see it in the Keith Morris link there. He was talking about exactly the same thing.
Can I say something? The funny thing is that when I made the decision in 1986, quite a conscious call decision to stop being a practicing artist,
yeah,
which I was then, and to do something about this situation. One of the first people I talked to was Keith Morris, because I used to work with Keith in the Barnes Centre.
Yeah,
And he said to me, pictures, right? I'll tell you what he said. Go down to the old theological college down on the prom there. He got lots of pictures there. I mean, Keith didn't know anything about them, but of course, being a local boy, he knew there were pictures in there. And actually, that was the starting point, because that's where I found the first painting by Hugh Hughes, mm-hmm, who I subsequently wrote my first book about.
Yeah.
And that was the starting point, really. So curiously, Keith was there at the start, actually. Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, that you mentioned the middle of the 80s there, because you did intentionally, therefore, split away from your you know, the physical work with sculpture and art and what have you. And that was the reason then? You felt there was essentially a gap?
Oh, yeah. It was one of the, you know, most things just happen to us, don't they? You know, you don't know why you've arrived where you've arrived. But that was different. That was a conscious decision. I was working up at Glyntlivon at the time with Delyth Preece. And Delyth and I talked a lot about the situation of visual culture in Wales. And it really came out of our discussions that something had to be done about this, because it was ridiculous. You know, the idea that that we were in some congenital way an unvisual nation, I mean, was just absurd. And I think we decided that something had to be done about it. And so I did. I made a cold, calm decision. Right, I'm going to do this. Didn't have any money, didn't have anywhere to start or anything. But that's what I did, because something had to be done.
And that certainly contributed massively to the understanding of visual culture in Wales, I suppose. And perhaps going back to this book and the future as well, how was writing this and collecting your recollections on that work after that conscious decision? Do you, in your practice now in researching, will you almost be informed by your own book and keep notes to tell the story of the research you're yet to do? That makes sense.
Yeah, it's a funny situation, because I've just been commissioned to write a new history of Welsh art. Let's call it that for shorthand. I don't usually use the word art; I prefer visual culture, but we'll say that for shorthand. Because the three big volumes that I wrote, the Visual Culture of Wales, they're out of print now. So we need a single volume history. We're back in a way. We're back where we were in the '70s. We haven't got a book. You know, if you want to find out about art in Wales, there ain't one.
It is an unbelievable situation.
It's ridiculous. I mean, you go to any sort of gallery in London, the Tate or whatever, and there's rows of books about Scottish art, there's rows of books about Irish art, you know, Norwegian art, and we haven't got a book.
As someone who's in the last couple of years began researching in the field as well, I find myself
having
to go back to David Bell and people like this, and you just think,
Lord help us,
there must be more to this. So a new researcher.
Well, anyway, the point is, but you asked about, you know, how this book affects what I might do in the future. It is curious, because I've just started work on this new book and having to go back and work in a more academic way and revisit things which I wrote about 20 years ago. But I don't just want to précis what I did before, because it is 20 years later, things have changed. And it's not just that there is a lot of new material, which there is, thank heavens. But, you know, times have changed, and context, as I said right at the start, history is about now, and now has moved on 20 years. So it does change my attitude, and I'm actually finding it very interesting just going through the process of adjustment. And it's amazing what you see. I've been looking today at 16th and 17th century Welsh portraits, quite a lot of which I wrote about in two of the volumes, two of the three big volumes. But going back and looking at them again and seeing different connections and looking at them, as it happens, in more dynastic terms this time rather than as isolated phenomena, I'm seeing them more as a group now. So, yeah, it does change things. But what I hope to do is not simply to précis what I've done before, but to try and move. I would say one thing about that is that one of the disappointments, I mean, I've been doing this since 1986 now, and with a few exceptions, there are some exceptions, but not many. I'm 65. Nobody else has come along so far and said, right, you know, what Peter Lord said, it's all very well, fair and fine, but it's out of date. We need to look at it this way. and taken a look at the big field. Quite a lot of people have written individual things about individual artists on that. It's great. But nobody's looked at the big picture again yet. And I'm slightly disappointed about that. And I kind of feel, I don't know whether I feel guilty about having to write this new book, but I kind of didn't perhaps expect to be the one to do it again, you know?
It could be, again, we're returning to that serendipitous aspect of this sort of uncannily untracked world. But I wonder if it's simply too much of a task. And really, Peter, to be perfectly frank, perhaps you're the only one that at this point in time could tackle something like this, which might in turn create a domino effect which would lead other people to...
Yeah, that's very nice of you to say so, but you know, I started knowing nothing. I mean, and it's the best place to start in a way, you know, knowing nothing.
Yeah.
And getting in there and finding out. And, you know, although I was employed to write the three big books, The Visual Culture of Wales, mm-hmm. I was employed at the Centre for Advanced Welsh and Celtic Studies. I mean, the first 86, 96, the first 10 years of what I did, which was the foundation of all that research, nobody paid me anything. I had to fund it myself, had to do jobs of one sort and another to pay for it. There was no money at all. And so I don't think that we should feel that we've got to wait for somebody to absorb everything that's been read and then get a nice job and sit down and write it. I mean, in a way, what was good about what I did was that there was an edge to it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it was perhaps one thing that I haven't said, which is very important, is that I didn't write the book primarily because I was interested in art history. The books that I've written, the two things I'm interested in are pictures and politics. It's always been like that. That's what I did at school, is pictures and politics. And the reason that we had to do something about that situation of nothing about Welsh visual culture and all that nonsense back in 1986 was not because I felt passionate about art history, but because I felt passionate about politics. Because we were in a position of... being an incomplete culture. There was this sense that in some way we couldn't sustain ourselves, that we were an inadequate culture. We had this piece missing. And so we had to look to England. As David Bell, you mentioned David Bell, actually says something along the lines of every piece of great art in Wales, we have to be thankful to our neighbours in England for. He actually says that.
It's quite a striking
thing. It's extraordinary.
Forgive me if I misremember this quote, but it says something about for all the domination and that our conquerors, etc., etc., we have much to be thankful for in terms of. And I just thought it was quite a curious juxtaposition.
Well, it's classic.
All these very negative words and then thankful.
Yeah.
And again, for reading that which still remains one of the very few early. Texts on art in Wales is quite striking. Really.
Yeah, it is. It's an extraordinary position. Well, it was very odd. And of course, anybody who's read anything I've written will know I constantly refer to the wonderful review of that book written by Mervyn Levy.
Oh,
extraordinary.
Classic.
Oh, absolutely classic demolition text. Absolutely wonderful. And I was fortunate enough to meet and talk to Mervyn Levy in the last year of his life.
It would be good to point people towards this. Is there a link? Is JSTOR or...?
You can find it. It's in the journal Wales,
it is.
I believe, which is available through the Welsh Journals online.
Yeah. Seek it out, people. That's a wonderful bit of text.
Can I also point you as well, in the following issue, there's a letter to editor, which you might expect to take issue with the a little bit scathing nature of this review, but the correspondent just wholeheartedly agrees, which is quite...
That's an unusual letter to print, really, isn't it?
Well, it was very funny because I got the backstory to that, talking to Mervyn Levy, because when I went to see him, he'd forgotten about this review that he'd written of Bell's book, and I reminded him and so on. And he sent me this wonderful postcard after. it's in my new book, this wonderful postcard of a female hand holding a pistol underneath a Sunset Boulevard, I think it is, like this. And he's annotated it for David Bell, you know, this shot going direction. And he says there that he didn't know, he'd forgotten about the review, and he'd also forgotten about the response that it generated, but he was delighted about it.
There's something to tease out here, isn't there, is the fact that you said it yourself, politics and pictures. Mm. Both of those responses seem to me to live on in the same sphere, isn't it? Sort of conquerors yet thankful. Mm-hmm. Is that a reason why? Is that another reason why you reacted to that space? Because there was lacking in the political sphere, and there was a lacking as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I came from outside, and in the early 1970s, I just couldn't understand this, you know, when I was first becoming acquainted with Welsh cultures, I couldn't understand this bizarre mixture of patriotism, which you get in David Bell, though you mentioned it, of patriotism, but also of, what's the word, taiogrwydd in Welsh, what's the word, sort of...
Sort of subservience.
Yeah, subservience, but there's another word for it, I can't remember now. But of a sort of forelock tugging, you know. It was the most bizarre combination, because to me the issue was simple. It was all about internal colonialism. Like, you know, whatever Di Smith says about it, you know, in strict factual historical terms, you know, okay, yes, we were never a colony, I suppose, in some sense. But I mean, the attitudes were colonialized. It was as plain as a pikestaff to anybody coming in. Well, not to anybody, to me anyway, coming in from the outside. I couldn't sit comfortably with that. I mean, to me, my friend Cliff McLucas, when we were talking about this years and years ago, about the language in particular, but it wasn't just to do with the language. As incomers, he said, look, you've got a choice when you come in. You can be part of the problem or part of the solution. And, you know, that's what incomers did on the whole back in the 70s. You opted one way or the other. It was quite clear because the politics at that time was much clearer than it is now. I mean, perhaps that's one of the reasons why the new writing about art history that we were talking about earlier hasn't happened on quite the scale that I hoped it'd happen. Perhaps it is a reflection of the fact that the politics are muddier now. You know, we've got this element of self-government and there's an element of complacency, I think, crept in.
There's a bit more ease about a lot of those aspects. Complacent, I think, is the right word. I don't need to build on that.
And there isn't the anger around the language either. You know, I happened to move into Wales, into a Welsh-speaking area, and I learned the language and so on. And you know, it was damn difficult at that time. You know, people were very, very angry. Mm-hmm. And rightly so, you know. I don't sense that anger so much now. And I would have to admit that, you know, I want to admit it. I'm proud of the fact my early books, especially, they're angry books, you know, because I thought what was going on was wrong.
From that early period, where did you settle afterwards, after writing those three major books?
Yeah, well, where did I settle? I mean, you mean in the sense of what did I feel after I'd written them?
Yeah.
Relief?
Is there a sense, is there a cathartic sense?
Well, there was to an extent at the time. But I mean, if you're going to be at all creative, you know, as soon as you finish one thing, you're thinking about the next thing. It's dead as a doornail when you've written it. I mean, any person, any painter, any writer will tell you that. You've got to be constantly on the next thing. And of course, that was a bit... When you've done a big piece of work like that, which has taken, 6 or 7 years, and you've, you know, to an extent become part of the establishment, because I was working for the University of Wales when I did it, you know, there was a big question. And I deliberately got out. There was a discussion at the centre about what I might do, how we might carry on with another project there. And two of my colleagues did, and they produced a very, very good book about biblical images of Wales, which is in the same format as the three big books. Excellent book. Mm-hmm. But I felt it was time to get out because I'm not institutional. I need the edge. I need to come from the side, really. It's going around the side of the table. That's my place. I know. You know, I applied twice for the job of curator of art at the National Museum, and I didn't get it either time. They interviewed me both times because they couldn't avoid me. You know, there was no way they were going to appoint me, and thank God they didn't. You know, because I couldn't have done it.
No, I can echo that. I think we would have lost an awful lot.
No, but thank you. But I couldn't have done that job. Really, I'd have upset too many people. You know, it was like Oliver Fairclough, who got the job the second time over me, who's done actually incredibly well. He is a man who works on the inside of institutions. You know, he knows how to turn the Queen Mary around slowly, and that's the way you do it in those places. Yeah. You know, and that the National Museum is transformed from where it was before. And that's not just me being ingratiating. I mean, it has. It's changed enormously, and a lot of that credit is Oliver's. I couldn't have done that because I'm a natural outsider. You know, always will be. I suppose actually that's one of the things that you ask where I am. That's one of the things that did emerge from being on the inside for 6 years, you know, working for the University of Wales. It's not my place. I don't do that very well, really.
Is that idea of being a natural outsider as well? I think that ties in with a few of your choices in terms of pictures you've chosen there. I'm thinking specifically Griffin Williams' picture of Jack Jones there. I think that might be tie in there. And as well, you mentioned Archie Griffiths.
But for one block.
Because I particularly drawn then, I think in the chapter on Archie Griffiths, there's one sentence there where I think he might suggest something like, this isn't just a perverse attraction to
failure.
To failure.
Yeah. No, it isn't. Of all the painters I've written about, I feel most intensely, I think, about Archie Griffiths. I mean, I've been able to collect a lot of his pictures. It's been like salvaging the last fragments of somebody's life. And, you know, I recount the stories of how it happened in the book. And I do feel a very strong bond with that work and with that story. And it is a tragedy. It's the story of somebody who, you know, in conventional ways, failed, you know, if you look at it in terms of his career as a painter. But that, and the tragedy of it is, of course, the work that he did produce in the 20s and the very early 30s is just so important. I think it's just terrific work. Mm-hmm. I've been really lucky in being able to gather some of it together. And one of the things about writing about somebody like Griffiths or Curlis Williams, of course, is that although they're dead, you know, I have spoken to people who knew them, who are still alive. And that gives you it's a very different kind of relationship. Yeah. To the relationship you have when you're talking about a painter like Edward Owen of Penrose, 18th century painter, who again I've recovered, but it's a different kind of relationship.
Is it as well that kind of relationship? It's a history you can almost touch it.
You can touch it.
Maybe then chapters like that in this book, that's the ideal forum for bringing up these kind of painters, these kind of people, because there is that personal element as well. Whereas a more cold academic piece of writing may not have had the same.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's right. Of course, you know, one of the things is if you're writing about these things in an autobiographical way and you're talking about people who are still alive, there are certain sort of ethical questions which arise. What do you say? What you don't say? What the things that you don't say? And you know that those are a matter of judgment. I hope I've made the judgments correctly in terms of what I've said and what I've left out. There's one other thing that I don't know why it's coming to my mind now, but it is relevant about the way I write about these things. I was trained as a visual artist, and I write like that too, in the sense that I remember very much observing the head of the Centre for Advanced Welsh and Celtic Studies at the time, Garrett H. Jenkins, very well-known historian, of course, observing how he wrote. I watched him a few times in the National Library. He'd set his papers out and he'd start with a capital letter and he'd write in this wonderful linear sort of screed and he'd finish with a full stop at the end, a few crossings out, but basically, you know, it'd start at the beginning and go through to the end. And I thought, how does he do that? You know, how on earth do you have that kind of organised mind? Because I work like a painter. So I write little bits, I paint little bits all over the canvas all at once. You work in the top left-hand corner, and then that doesn't work at the bottom right-hand corner, so you do a bit there, and then there's a bit in the middle which doesn't fit those, and the colour there doesn't fit that. So it's a very much a painterly approach, and I'm sure to somebody like, well, I know, because I've worked with him, Geraint found that infuriating, you know, the sort of that kind of way. But that's the way I approach writing. It is like a painting. And you get a very different kind of result.
It also confuses anybody trying to catalogue any archives as well.
This is true.
Yes. Look for what's in your diaries.
Oh, God. Well, I don't keep a diary. You'll be relieved to hear.
Well, we could go on for quite some time here, I feel. And I'm sure there's some little bits and bobs that we could return to maybe at a later date. I think there's a lot aching to come out of that head, Peter. So thanks a lot for coming in.
Pleasure.
I believe you're off to Venice.
Yes, not to the Biennale. It just happens to be that the Biennale is on. But this is a return visit. The last time I was there was when I was a student, an art student in 1969, and all I can remember is getting extremely drunk, which I won't do this time.
Don't fall into the canal if you
know.
No,
I won't do that.
Lloyd, thanks to you as well. We'll be hearing from you in the next podcast. Is this coming out as an digital
ebook? It's coming out as an ebook. Yes, the relationships with pictures will be out as an ebook in the very near future.
Excellent. I'll provide as much of a close link as I can to that. So check out the links below. And thanks a lot for listening.